Hi, this is Janie Reasoner, and welcome to Women's Voices. I'm happy to be with you once again. Before I introduce my guest, Sandra Steingraber, I'd like to share with you some of what I've been reading. Three books in particular. Gabor Mate's book, In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction. The blurb reads, in this well-documented book, Gabor Mate boldly challenges the war on drugs and locates the source of addictions in the trauma of an emotionally empty and often, I add, very abusive childhood, making it a relational rather than a medical problem. Such a radical thesis of cause leads to a human connection, a passionate and compassionate book. End of quote. He is quite wonderful to listen to. If you Google his name, Gabor Mate, G-A-B-O-R-M-A-T-A, you'll find a number of YouTube videos of him speaking. Next is Your Body's Many Cries for Water. You are not sick, you are thirsty. F. Batman, M.D., as a result of his extensive clinical and scientific research, concludes that the body possesses many different thirst signals, and different symptoms and signs of dehydration have until now been viewed as classical diseases of the body, such as arthritis, hypertension, ulcers, acid reflux. It is available from our wonderful library. And finally, Sandra Steingraber's newest book is Raising Elijah, Protecting Children in an Age of Environmental Crisis, which we'll soon be talking about. I feel these are important books that address many of the current traumas and health issues facing all of us, particularly as we age, and they are all connected one way or another to our health and well-being. Not an easy task to undertake as we survey our increasingly poisoned air, water, soil, and our psyches, and everything we touch, from our cooking utensils, the clothing we wear, and the food and drink we consume. It's rather amazing that we are still alive when you consider how overwhelmed this earth is, and each of us, with our own load of man-made poisons, and additionally, for many, overwhelming stress, as increasing and frightening violence and militarism escalates in every arena. And then, for we women, there are the draconian laws against our health and basic rights over our own bodies. Where does it stop? Or more to the question, how can we make it stop?
Our life goes on along its merry way. We're looking for the good times, the fun and the play. While inside is an aching that won't go away. And we wonder why in heaven are we here today. We fight with our children, wives and husbands too. Angry, hurtful feelings running clear through. And the pain of it all dulls all that we do. And we wonder how much more we have to suffer through. Story, sad but true, of violence and killing and wars planned anew, of child abuse and battering done by men the world through, and we women wonder why must we be your way into my constant love so true. It's the only way to heaven and peace on earth too. And so I tell you in words straight and true.
Ecologist, author, and cancer survivor, Sandra Steingraber, PhD, is an internationally recognized authority on the environmental links to cancer and human health. Sandra's highly acclaimed book, Living Downstream, An Ecologist's Personal Investigation of Cancer in the Environment, presents cancer as a human rights issue. Originally published in 1997, it was the first to bring together data on toxic releases with data from U.S. cancer registries, and won praise from international media, including the Washington Post, Publishers Weekly, The Lancet, and the London Times. Before I read her book, I didn't know where cancer came from. Nobody else did either that I knew. We thought it fell out of the sky, or back in the Midwest, they thought it was just God's will. Continuing the investigation begun in Living Downstream, Steingraber's book, Having Faith, An Ecologist's Journey to Motherhood, is both a memoir of her own pregnancy and an investigation of fetal toxicology. Having Faith reveals the extent to which environmental hazards now threaten each stage of infant development. In the eyes of an ecologist, the mother's body is the first environment for life. The Library Journal selected Having Faith as the best book of 2001, and it was featured in a PBS documentary by Bill Moyers. Called A Poet with a Knife by Sojourner Magazine, Steingraber has received many honors for her work as a science writer, among them receiving the Environmental Health Champion Award from Physicians for Responsibility, the Rachel Carson Leadership Award, and in 2010 was named as one of the 25 Visionaries Who Are Changing Your World by Utney Reader. An enthusiastic and sought-after public speaker, Steingraber has testified in the European Parliament before the President's Cancer Panel and has participated in briefings to Congress and before United Nations delegates in Geneva, Switzerland. A columnist and contributing editor for Orion magazine, Sandra Steingraber is currently a scholar in residence in Ithaca College in Ithaca, New York. She is married to the artist Jeff DeCastro, and they live in a 1,000-square-foot house with a push mower, a clothesline, a vegetable garden, and two beloved children. Her newest book is Raising Elijah, Protecting Children in an Age of Environmental Crisis. Throughout, Steingraber demonstrates how closely the intimate world of parenting connects to the public world of policymaking, and how the ongoing environmental crisis is fundamentally a crisis of family life. She calls for federal regulations that assess chemicals for their ability to alter puberty before they are allowed access to the marketplace, and also highlights a growing child's special needs and vulnerabilities, observing that many doctors, scientists, and governing bodies assume all members of the population basically act biologically like middle-aged men. Welcome, Sandra, to Women's Voices.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's so happy you could be here, and thank you for staying up late.
Yeah, it is a little later here in the East.
It is. You know, my first question is, what part did your own mother play in your becoming the woman that you are today?
Oh, well, it's, of course, a huge part. I'm sure any daughter would say that. Although my story is probably different than most of your listeners, I was adopted, and so I was born in 1959. So my mom, who had been part of the first generation in her family to get to go off to college, had majored in biology, which was an unusual choice for a woman in the 1940s. And she had to basically give up her career when she became an adoptive mother. The deal of the day was, you're expected to stay home with your, if you're going to get a baby, you had to stay home. And so, so I had a microscope by the time I was nine, and my very first memory of my mom and me is cracking fossils open on the front stoop of the house. So she had a very sort of scientific childhood, thanks to my mom being kind of thwarted in her own dreams. She was diagnosed with breast cancer when I was 15, and she was in her mid-40s. 2 years later, she had metastatic disease, just as I was going off to college. And so even though by temperament, I would say I was more interested in stage, I was involved in school plays and acting, I was in the creative writing program and wrote a lot of poetry, you know, there was this other interest I had that I shared with my mom. So it was, I was trying to decide, as all kids do, you know, when they go off to college, what's it going to be, you know, the creative writing and theater or biology. And I guess I decided to carry my mom's banner on. And so then when I was diagnosed with cancer 2 years later at age 20, my mom and I then became co-cancer patients together. And then I made a decision to try to do both, to try to go back and study poetry and write poetry again. I just wasn't interested in giving up anything that I loved. But I needed biology more than ever because it gave me a language to talk to my physicians with and answer that question, why me? So my mom really set me on the path of biology, and that's a path I'm still on. She also taught me how to hope and fight even when the chips are down. Her lesson to me was never let them bury you until you're dead. And that's become my motto, too. I guess I should say here, my mom was 44 when she was first diagnosed. She was basically given a death sentence at age 46, and she's still alive. She's going to be 82 this year, so she's one of the 2% of women with metastatic breast cancer who's still alive more than three decades after her diagnosis.
That's wonderful.
And, of course, you know, I should say other people and other women have fought just as hard and valiantly as my mom, who are now non-survivors. So I'm not saying that trying hard offers you a better chance of surviving. I'm just saying I'm lucky that my mom's still here, and I'm lucky that...
You're still here.
She taught me the lessons that she did.
Yes. Yes. Do you, at this point, I imagine you've figured out why both of you got cancer.
Well, I don't know if I have. You know, my mom and I are two data points in a kind of cluster of cancers in the hometown where I grew up.
Right.
That's and knowing that I'm adopted and knowing that my aunt actually died of the same kind of bladder cancer that I had. My mom had breast cancer and I had bladder cancer. I just began to think about what else families have in common other than chromosomes. So that, and I was also prompted by questions that my own diagnosing physician had for me about the kind of environmental exposures I had as a child. So that really set me on the path that I'm on now. So I didn't go off to medical school. Instead, I went into the field of public health, and now I've written a trilogy of books, as you so eloquently described at the beginning of our program, on the ways in which environmental health and human health are interrelated.
We have a lot to discuss. I'm speaking with Sandra Steingraber, and her newest book is...
Raising Elijah.
Thank you.
Named after my now 10-year-old son, Elijah, who himself is named after the abolitionist Elijah Lovejoy, who's somebody kind of famous in Illinois, maybe not so known to your listeners in your part of the world, but Elijah Lovejoy was an early abolitionist in the 1830s who was arguing for divorcing our economy from its ruinous dependency on slave labor at a time when almost nobody else was saying that. And he was assassinated in the free state of Illinois for those words. I'm interested in resurrecting the spirit of Elijah Lovejoy, which is why I call the book Raising Elijah, raising the spirit of Elijah Lovejoy for our age, I'm interested in exploring how we can be contemporary abolitionists and demand that we divorce our economy from a ruinous dependency on fossil fuels, which is killing the planet and killing ourselves. So that's kind of the starting point for my latest book.
Mm-hmm. Beautifully put. You're right now in the middle of New York State wanting to start fracking.
Yes, we're in the fight of our lives here, and I feel like I've come straight from the barricades to talk to you tonight. So our situation here in New York with this form of extreme fossil fuel extraction known as fracking is a little bit different than any other state in that our previous governor, Patterson, put in place a moratorium on that practice for good reasons, because fracking has troubling evidence linking it both to contamination of our air and water. It, of course, industrializes our rural landscape and sends lava flows of sediment into surface streams, but also because there are potential human health consequences to that. And so the previous governor said we need to study this and understand the health and environmental impacts before we can move forward. So we've had this moratorium in place, and a study was done. It's 1,500 pages. And can I just say that the word children does not appear anywhere in those 1,500 pages? I think that basically summarizes my thoughts on what is left out of this document. So it weighs 15 pounds and basically does not even attempt to address public health consequences.
Yeah.
From my point of view as an ecologist, it's not a piece of scientific investigation at all. It's basically an infomercial for fracking. If you tried to, you know, send this to peer review and have it published, it wouldn't just be sent back for revision. It would simply be a rejected document. It just doesn't even attempt to objectively review the literature or actively seek out the most accurate data on the questions that it poses.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been roundly criticized. In fact, it's gone through two iterations now and been revised, and public hearings have happened all over the state. The public has packed the public hearings. More than 70,000 comments have been submitted in critiquing largely the document, and the state of New York is required to respond to all these comments and then revise the document accordingly. Or it could simply decide to withdraw it, which would be the correct, in my opinion, the correct choice. Nevertheless, in the last week, our Governor Cuomo has let it be known through the New York Times that there is a possible plan to roll out fracking in the southernmost of our counties, along what's called the Southern Tier, which is along our border with Pennsylvania, where fracking is in the middle of a big kind of frenzied rush. And we were hearing all kinds of terrible stories from what's happening there, and have met with people who have suffered grave problems, both in terms of the loss of their drinkable water, loss of property value, and in some cases alleged serious health problems that nobody's really investigating. So because we live so close to the border, we can see the effects, you know, just not far from us. And we've held the line here, but now the decision seems to be that we'll roll this practice out in our most in some of our really economically struggling and therefore vulnerable communities. So on Wednesday, a number of us will be at the State House objecting to this kind of form of environmental discrimination, and also just the idea that, you know, supposedly we're still in the middle of reviewing the science to decide whether we should continue the moratorium, ban the practice altogether, or how we're going to move forward. We haven't even figured out what we're going to do with all the toxic, you know, the toxic wastewater that it's produced. Mm-hmm. We have no plan for that yet. And so with all these unanswered scientific questions, nobody's supposed to be thinking about how we're going to roll this out yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a lot of things to be alarmed at, because it almost seems as though the decision has been taken before the science has been done. That's how it appears to some of us.
That's how it often happens, doesn't it?
It gives people the sense of, you know, very an unfair process that here we are, we're being asked as the public to read a 1,537-page document and then offer our comments on it, which in good faith are supposed to be read and responded to. And, you know, people have driven across the state and testified in hearings and given up their vacation days to get on buses, and everyone's taken this very seriously. And it actually is the case that, you know, this is all just a charade. There's going to be a lot of it really upset and angry people, for sure.
Do health issues, you say they're really not mentioned. Are they a legitimate reason to not do it? Are they considered in this process?
They haven't been considered, and with the rationale that we don't need to really consider them because we're going to have really good regulations, and therefore, if there's no exposures, then there's no reason to really study the problem. So,
you know,
maybe we should just back up and talk about what fracking is, because I think it
is,
you know, still a new idea for a lot of folks, and those of us who are in the thick of this big civil rights fight here. So essentially, it's fracking is a way, it's short for hydraulic fracturing. So it's a way of turning water into a club to shatter bedrock. By doing that, you can force to the surface tiny bubbles of either oil or gas. And of course, petroleum refers to kind of both things. If it's liquid at room temperature, we call it oil, and if it's a vapor, then we call it gas. We've known for quite a long time that there are these parts of our nation that used to be 500 million years ago, 400 million years ago, they used to be ancient ocean bottoms. And then the silt that trapped all these dead creatures, you know, the bodies of all the creatures would die, and they would sink down to the bottom and become trapped in the silt. And at that time on the planet, there wasn't as much oxygen in the water as there is now, and therefore these creatures turned into bubbles of methane, in the case of natural gas, and then became trapped as tiny bubbles. And then under lots of time and under immense pressure, then that silt turned into shale. And so, but the bubbles are trapped in there, and there's no way to make them flow. It's not like you can just stick a straw down in the ground and intercept a big bubble of gas, a giant pocket of gas. That's the old-fashioned way of drilling, so-called vertical drilling. And we pretty much run through most of our supplies of natural gas in the ground that could be accessed by vertical drilling. So in 2005, Halliburton unveiled a newish technology. Well, it was actually before 2005, but the laws changed to make it commercially viable. So anyway, less than 10 years ago, across the nation, starting from the west and moving east, was a newish form of getting natural gas out of the ground, which involved drilling sideways. So you could go down, straight down a mile, but then turn the drill bit and go sideways through the shale, like a kind of robotic mole. And then you could combine horizontal drilling with hydraulic fracturing, which means taking 4 to 9 million gallons of fresh water, mixing it with a kind of sequence of chemicals, and then putting that under the ground, and then under 15,000 pounds per square inch of pressure, which is about like the force that you would exert if you swung a baseball bat against a chalkboard, then you would blow up the shale. And now the gas bubbles then are free to flow out, except that as soon as you release the pressure, the weight of the earth is going to close up all those cracks that you just created. So you need to shove something into the cracks to hold them open. And what we use is silica sand. And that's being now strip mined all throughout the Midwest. Mm. So even before the first drill goes into the ground, lots of damage is caused by the open strip mining for this special kind of sand. Silica sand is kind of the Samson of sand grains, and it can resist the pressure of the earth and still hold open the shale. And so
I know you wrote about
this. Silica, of course, is a carcinogen, and so the dangers to human health begin with the people who live in the communities where sandstone is being mined, and that would be in Illinois and in Wisconsin and Minnesota. So basically, the sand counties that Aldo Leopold wrote about in Wisconsin are being loaded onto rail cars and being sent off to the oil fields of North Dakota or the gas fields of Pennsylvania.
And they can just do this and all this blows around and there's nothing to say they can't.
That's right. That's right.
And
so this is a very underregulated industry for a very particular and important reason. In 2005, fracking was exempt, was granted exemptions from many of our stalwart federal laws, like the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, and so forth. And so, you know, there's almost no other industrial activity where you could just dig a hole in the ground and pour a human carcinogen in. That would be a criminal act in most cases.
If you are
using inherently toxic chemicals and you're releasing them into the environment, either as fumes or as water, you know, discharges into rivers and streams, you would certainly have to tell the public what it is you've done and what kind of ingredients you're using. But that doesn't apply to fracking. Dealing with secrecy, so that makes it really hard on us in the scientific community to even know what kind of health effects to look for. So, you know, when we see a lot of nosebleeds in a community, we wonder if people have been exposed to benzene, but it's hard to get data on that. So if we start seeing, let's say, a cluster of childhood leukemias, in an area, we don't know if it's due to exposures or not, because we don't see what I did in living downstream, and I spent a lot of years doing it, and it was hard work, but at least it's doable. Is take toxics registry, the TRI data, toxics release inventory data. So for most large industry, they're required to report what they're releasing into the environment. And then you can use those data and then compare it with the cancer registry data from any zip code or county that you're interested in to see if certain kinds of industry and certain kinds of practices keep recurring with certain kinds of cancers. And, you know, like aluminum smelters, for example, you see associated with bladder cancer. But with this industry, we can't even kind of ask the same questions that we can ask for other sort of industrial practices. So it makes it really tough. And it also kind of casts a veil of secrecy on the whole operation. It's hard to know what's going on.
It's outrageous. It's simply outrageous. I'm speaking with Sandra Steingraber, and we're speaking now about fracking. And you have your own fight there, and you also, I think, wanted to say something about what's happening in California regarding fracking.
I do. And I'll say that here in New York, I consider myself a pretty observant person about what's going on in my environment. And somehow, while I wasn't looking, 40% of the land in the county that I live in, here in the Finger Lakes area, was leased to the gas industry. And so I am surrounded by land that's leased. This isn't just anymore for me an interesting and important thing to study for the sake of other people or for the sake of my children's generation. This is an immediate threat to me as a cancer survivor and to my 10-year-old son, Elijah, who has a history of asthma. There's land that I can see from my house, fields that where drill rigs could go up. And so we're trying to do the science. We're trying to meet with affected people from Pennsylvania and piece together some kind of understanding of what these risks are while this is being, you know, in real time as it's being unfolded. And so I feel as though California can take advantage of several things that have already been done. And before regulations lock in fracking as part of the economy of California. It's already there already, and it's already been done. Kind of again, nobody was paying attention, and it is. Kind of, there's no nothing to stop it from being done. But happily now in California, there is a public conversation going on in your state house in Sacramento. But there's everything that we've learned here in New York over the past 4 years, where we've tried to pull together data on what happens to air quality, what happens to water, and so forth. And California could really take advantage of that. In addition, the National Academy of Sciences released a report recently that examined the question of whether fracking is related to earthquakes, and whether the injection of all the toxic waste from fracking, where we re-inject it into the ground, might be related to earthquakes. And of course, with so much of California in a seismically active zone, that's a really important question. Another thing that's really important for California is the water issue. You know, here in the East, we have plenty of water. We have many, many people living very close together. New York is the third most populous state in the Union, and we occupy a pretty small geographic space compared to California. So we're even in our rural areas. There's like sort of one dairy farm after another, and then there's a vineyard, and so we're all kind of packed in here. And so there's just sort of no way to go put these drill rigs up. They're going to be in, you know, cow pastures, in people's communities, right next to schools and so forth. And so we already have air quality problems from, you know, coal-burning power plants in the Ohio Valley and all kinds of other industries. So we have ozone non-attainment days when the air pollution exceeds legal limits. And so on top of that, now we're going to add 1,000 trucks per well, times thousands of wells. We're going to add all the different volatile fumes that are going to come off the wellheads themselves, and then the compressors and condensers release their own air pollution, lots of diesel, and that's going to be added to the mix. That kind of air pollution kills people. There's just no doubt about it. We know a lot about that kind of air pollution. It causes asthma in children. It causes stroke and heart attack in older people. It's been linked to memory loss in older women. It's been linked to learning disabilities in children, and so forth. And those are expensive problems to solve. And yet we haven't looked at those costs. We haven't put a price tag on that, even though this environmental impact statement is happy to put a price tag on the increase in tax revenues and jobs and things like that that this industry will allegedly bring. And so California could learn a lesson from that, because California, like New York, has air quality problems already without adding more. But I think even for California, even more acutely, is the water issue, because we worry about where we're going to put all the contaminated water. You know, we're deliberately poisoning mass amounts of fresh water, and then when it comes back out of the ground, we don't have a plan, just like nuclear waste. We don't know where to put it. It has to be contained forever, and it's also radioactive now, because at least here in the East, the shale below our feet is quite is full of radon and full of radium-226 and uranium and so forth. And so it's briny, it's radioactive, it's got all those toxic chemicals you needed to add to it to frack in the first place, heavy metals, and we have to figure out a way where to put it. So it's ruined. The water is ruined, and some of it is actually exits the hydrological cycle and is entombed forever in the deep geological strata a mile below the water table. And the stuff that does come back up it's not drinkable. You can't put it anywhere. You have to find a safe place to forever incarcerate it. So what about California? You know, there are already water shortages. Do you really have the water to spare to use to blow up the bedrock and turn it into poison? So, I mean, there are just very real issues, I think, that we've already articulated here in New York that could really be of use to California. But more interesting to me, actually, in a writerly way, is the fact that, you know, the gas rush is constantly compared to the gold rush. Is it a speculative bubble? There's all this kind of piling on. People are ignoring the danger signs and the downsides to this. It's a boom and bust extractive process. So these comparisons are actually very accurate. I began to study the original California Gold Rush to see, you know, what other lessons might be learned. And recently, and I guess this is when you and I met each other recently in California, I was on my way last month to visit the original site of the original Gold Rush up in the Sierra Nevada mountains at the community called Nevada City. And there's a wonderful organization there called the Sierra Springs Institute that has been monitoring all the toxic chemicals that are still leaching out of the ground from the original Gold Rush, which, you know, the first sort of industrial-style gold extraction operations took place there. So 150 years ago, we did all these things that we still don't understand the consequences of, but we do know that for every, you know, ounce of gold that was taken out of the ground, about 10 ounces of mercury went into the ground. And then we also unearthed, by turning the earth inside out like this, unearthed all kinds of other toxic substances like arsenic. And now we've built a whole community on top of it, including playing fields and schools and neighborhoods, and there are all these mine shafts and tailings piled up with trees growing on them now and so forth. And there has never been a comprehensive health assessment done 150 years later, and people are now worried that they're seeing excess cancer rates. And so finally, I think, the state of California is going to be looking into this thanks to an assist from a wonderful organization that I've worked with in the past called the California Breast Cancer Research Program.
Wonderful.
And so, you know, here it is 150 years later, and we're finally going to take a look at the possible health effects of turning this part of California into a kind of toxic minefield. So what lesson does that have for us as we're beginning another gold rush, you know, this time called the gas rush? And we're also going to turn the earth inside out. In fact, some of the techniques are very similar. You know, I was taken to the site up in the Sierra Hills where this kind of water cannon was shot at the side of a hill, turning it into a cliff, and essentially hydraulically fracturing this hillside to get the gold out. And even though that took place on the surface of the earth, it's not so different from what we're proposing to do to this landscape under our feet. We can't see what we're destroying, but we know it's a living ecosystem, that the shale is actually full of organisms that, you know, these deep life organisms, kind of relic organisms that live down there. I mean, that's one of the reasons fracking is so toxic, is that we have to deploy powerful poisons to kill off living organisms, otherwise they slime up the pipes and interfere with the flow of gas.
How ghastly.
So we're kind of blowing up our basement, if you will, the basement of our house, the house that is our planet, and blowing up all the things that inhabit that world that we can't see, but whose integrity we really depend upon. And so I found a really profound lesson by going up into the hills in the Sierra Nevadas and seeing the damage left over from 150 years previous that's never been mitigated and is still possibly causing harm to the people that live there. Surely we don't have to keep repeating that kind of history. So I think Northern California has a really important lesson to offer the whole nation right now, because we stand on this amazing crossroads. We can either continue down this ruinous path of fossil fuel extraction, which now that we've used up all the easy-to-get fossil fuels is only leading us into ever more toxic and dangerous places. You know, we're going to blow up mountaintops in Appalachia to get the coal out. We're going to sink tubes 6 miles down into the deep ocean to get the oil out. We're going to build pipelines from Alberta all the way down to southern Louisiana to get tar out of soil, destroying a forest to do so, and we're going to blow up the bedrock under our feet to get some methane out of it at a time when we know that it's the most urgent task before us is to get ourselves off of carbon altogether, to decarbonize, and to move as swiftly as we can to renewables. So the problem is not just the toxic chemicals and the ruin of the earth from fracking. The added to that is the diversion of capital, human capital and actual monetary capital, to laying out this incredible industrial infrastructure across our rural landscape instead of investing in the things we know we need to invest in, solar and wind and so forth. In fact, natural gas is now the biggest obstacle to investment in what we know we really need to be doing. So the whole thing, is, as far as I can see, is just a tragedy from any point of view, economically, ecologically, public health, and so forth.
Indeed. Indeed. That's sobering, terribly sobering.
Well, let me put a slightly more joyful context to this. I think fracking is the human rights issue of our time right now because it represents the biggest change to our nation's landscape than anything else we've done mm-hmm. since we cleared the forests in the 19th century. Fracking is being rolled out in 34 different states, and it industrializes our rural areas. It cuts down the trees. It turns the earth inside out, lays this whole kind of industrial process over what would otherwise be, you know, rural communities, cow pastures, country roads, and so forth. But people are fighting back. I mean, yesterday we saw in Columbus, Ohio, massive demonstrations, thousands of people from the reports I heard marching and going to the State House on Father's Day, right, with, you know, carrying their Don't Frack Ohio signs. We have a very vigorous resistance movement here in New York and so forth. And so in the midst of all this, this year I was the fortunate recipient of a Heinz Award for my work in environmental health. This comes from the Heinz Family Foundation. And so this summer I received a phone call from Teresa Heinz Kerry herself, the wife of our Senator John Kerry, formerly the wife of John Heinz, of the Heinz Ketchup family. And so, that's a thrill. It was a great honor for me to receive that. And it comes with a $100,000 cash prize. I happened to be in Utah when I got the phone call, and I had just attended, just by circumstance, I had attended the sentencing of the anti-fracking activist Tim DeChristopher in Salt Lake City, who had successfully disrupted what turned out to be the illegal leasing mm-hmm. of land near some of our national parks in southern Utah mm-hmm. for oil and gas drilling. And he successfully bid against the oil and gas industry.
Remember that.
But yes, yeah, so, but he didn't have the money in the bank, right? So he was charged with fraud. But his actions actually exposed the fact that this was an illegal sale, and so the land truly was saved. But he was then, last year, July 26th, he was sentenced to 2 years in prison. And so I was there on the day that happened, and he was hauled away in chains by federal marshals, but not until he looked at the judge and said, "This is what love looks like."
Yeah.
I was profoundly moved by this. And I had, you know, just been traversing the country last summer, doing some preliminary exploration of fracking to see, you know, to go to the places where it's being practiced and to start thinking about how I wanted to study this. And so lo and behold, I happened to be there in, I just come from southern Utah, so I went to Salt Lake to see this. So then I got a phone call from Teresa about the Heinz Award. Well, I went out into the desert, and I thought really hard, and I kept thinking about those words that Tim said, you know, this is what love looks like. And I just knew what I needed to do, which is to donate this prize money to the fight against fracking in New York. So that's what I did, and I have to say it's been an amazing experience because as a cancer patient, you know, I don't enjoy medical security, and anybody who has cancer will tell you that, and I've had a kind of cancer that is, of all human cancers, the one most likely to recur. Bladder cancer recurs in 70% of all patients. So I'm under intense medical surveillance. And for my whole adult life, I've been in and out of the hospital getting checkups, usually every few months. So even, you know, 3 days from now, I have a cystoscope and a renal ultrasound scheduled. So this is just my life. And it's very expensive. And so the $100,000 is basically the only chunk of money I would have. And so for me, it's a huge thing, pushing this money out into the community. For the oil and gas industry, of course, it's nothing. You know, it's less than the cost of one commercial. But I was hoping that in spite of that differential, that because it was such a big gesture for me, kind of giving everything I have with my whole heart, that it would inspire other people to do heroic things, to not give in to this sort of defeatism or sense of inevitability, like, well, what can you do? You know, it's Exxon, it's Halliburton. These are the biggest industries in the world. You can't fight them. Well, yes, we can. And, you know, my dad had to go fight Hitler when he was 18, and I think the Wehrmacht looked pretty powerful, right, at the time. It was supposed to be like the thousand-year reign. And yet, you know, it wasn't like you could just sit on the sidelines and say, well, I don't think we can win against Hitler, so why even try? I mean, that. So my father, you know, was always forever quoting Winston Churchill to me about how, you know, we will fight in the beaches and we shall fight in the fields and we shall fight in the landing docks and we shall never surrender. And that's really, you know, together with my mom's directive of don't let them bury you until you're dead, those are kind of my guiding philosophies. So my adoptive parents kind of really gave me the words I now that kind of animate my activism as a cancer survivor and as a biologist. And so this seed money from my Heinz Award was used to start a coalition we convened a coalition of all these different grassroots groups, and we call ourselves New Yorkers Against Fracking. We have more than 100 different groups now, and hundreds of different businesses as well. So it's not just you know, nonprofit and grassroots groups, but also, you know, wineries and dairies and businesses that depend on a healthy environment and depend on tourism and so forth. And so I think we're a mighty coalition, and we're one of, you know, several of anti-fracking voices in the state of New York. So I guess with that old-fashioned idea that if we organize and all speak in one voice, we become a force to deal with. And so we'll see. So we're going off to Albany on the 20th. Been there many times this year. And we bring with us representatives from each of the five counties that the governor is proposing to frack. We want to bring the voices of people on the far side of the shale gas curtain to talk about what will be lost if we make this precipitous step, try to put some human faces behind the data. Mm. Of course, I'll bring the data too.
Mm. Mm. It's so touching and so heartwarming. And certainly you will be a force to be contended with. And then it's an example for the rest of us. This is what you're thinking, that fracking can bring people together from every place.
I do. You know, I mean, this is a technology that was rolled out in very remote areas, eastern Utah, western Colorado, southern Wyoming, and has managed in the few short years that it's turned those once beautiful places into gas patches. It's managed to contribute to many documented cases of water contamination, both ground and surface water, and in addition, to turn formerly pristine air into smoggy air that has more ozone than downtown Los Angeles. So now that we're both rolling it east toward highly populated areas in the east that already suffer from air pollution problems, and where many, many people live. You know, we've got millions of people in New York as opposed to not so many people in southern Wyoming. So the public health issue looms much larger. But also as we then roll it west to California, where you also have densely populated places and lack of water and some pretty bad air quality problems already. So I think New York and California, both of these states, and having lived in both, I always have to laugh because they both say, you know, as California goes, so goes the nation. Well, we say, as New York goes, so goes the nation. So we both see ourselves as bellwether states, and in some way I think we both are. Mm. So I think both New York and California could be transformational states mm-hmm. in this battle to... Well, I don't like military language, but this real powerful struggle to move us away from this you know, yet another form of fossil fuels to turn on the lights. Let's just keep, you know, shoveling fossil fuels in an oven, lighting it on fire to turn the lights on. What a 19th century primitive technology, you know. And as the adults in the room, I just feels like it's the job of my generation now to solve this problem, to get us off of carbon. I feel that very powerfully in the way that my dad's generation had to, you know, defeat and vanquish global fascism. That was the great work of his generation. But this is my generation, and I just refuse as a mom to push this off any longer, to make my children deal with it when they have to grow up. I just want it done. First of all, we don't have time anymore. We're very close to global tipping point where even if we pulled back on the carbon emissions and got ourselves off of carbon, you know, if we don't exactly in the scientific community know where that point is, but we know we're approaching it within 5 to 10 years. And then, you know, then things will happen, like the permafrost will keep melting and methane will be released, and that will warm things more, which will melt more permafrost, and we'll be in these terrible positive feedback loops. Yes. So if we don't want to reach that point, we need to do something right now.
That's right.
And I think that is actually an issue of parenting, because that's my job, right, as a parent, is to provide for my children and provide for their future and to protect my children from harm. I mean, those are, as far as I can see, all the tasks of parenting kind of fall into those two categories. You have to provide for their future and protect them in the meantime. And so I can't do that if one in every four mammal species are going extinct and the pollinators are in trouble and the plankton in the ocean is starting to get wobbly, because that provides half of the oxygen that we breathe. So it's my job now as a mother in this moment in history to take on this problem. Huge problem, really difficult problem, but a heroic one, one that we all have ideas about and we can all get involved in, because really what it means is we have a terrible design problem. We've designed our agricultural system and our transportation system and our electrical grid in these kind of bad ways. So we need more elegant design. So we need engineers to work on this. We need attorneys to help us figure out how to create incentives. We need artists and writers to open up a space in the culture and help people open their hearts and minds, because there's so much grief about our current situation. People won't even talk about it.
Yeah.
They just turn away, almost like good Germans. They don't want to see the signs of atrocity. Well, if we don't look at the problem, we're never going to get to a solution. But I think sometimes you can't tell people straight, because it just, they just feel their eyes glaze over and they can't deal with it. So that's where I think the arts come in. So one of the things I was able to do with my Heinz Award money, for example, we used some of it to have a series of concerts in which we had people like Natalie Merchant and some other headliners really find, sort of unite us under common cause with music, which of all the arts, I think, has this kind of effect of bringing people together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you think of the Civil War songs and the Vietnam War songs and the Civil Rights era, there was always music, you know, for this
yes.
great task.
Yes.
And so I think that helps inspire people mm-hmm. and make it seem less depressing as well. And so this is a great moment where I think we're all called on to bring whatever we have, whatever skill sets we have. Mm-hmm. And you know, God knows, I am actually a fairly painfully shy person. I don't like political confrontation. I'm much happier explaining things to people. So one of my roles I see is this sort of an educator, and I really am pleased that we have some really good community organizers and some political strategists working with New Yorkers Against Fracking, because I wouldn't want to do that work myself. But that's why we need all of us here in this moment.
We do, Sandra. Bravo for all that you're saying. It's very touching and it's very inspiring. Would you give your website so people can learn more about you?
Yeah, I'll give a couple different things. So steingraber.com, just my last name, which, by the way, is German for by the stony ditch, which I always thought was a good name for an ecologist. So steingraber.com is my website. And then Raising Elijah has its own Facebook page, and my readers have really turned it into a forum on fracking. So for those listeners who want to get more involved with that, I would really say, and you're part of the Facebook world, you might want to check out Raising Elijah by Sandra Steingraber on Facebook. So it's the name of the book, and then by Sandra Steingraber on Facebook. And then the coalition that I helped to found, New Yorkers Against Fracking has its own Facebook page and website, and so anybody who's really interested in, you know, the actual political in and out of what we're doing.
We have 30 seconds. We have.
You know, what we love, we must protect. I guess that is that's my main point tonight, and I hope Raising Elijah the book.
It's a wonderful
will,
book.
Help people, you know, find a place to start in their own lives.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful book. We didn't get to touch it. We'll have to do this again because you say a lot about autism and all of the things that are plaguing us. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me as your guest.
Yes. Good night.
Good night.